Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
Hello Fiona and hello everyone listening.
Gail, I hope you have a triumphant writing week to tell us about, to make a contrast with mine.
Triumphant would not exactly be the word that I would attach to this week. I've had a strange writing week. I've been doing a lot of those end bits of writing. So I've had a Katie Gale that was in structural edit phase, but it wasn't a bad structural edit. But so that's making changes to that manuscript. And I had a proof arrive that, and I'm not very good at proofreading my own books, but this one I got weirdly sucked into. I think as a procrastination tool, that if I was reading the proof, I didn't have to be writing another book. I'm in that 30 to 40,000 word phase with my work in progress. I'm doubting everything about it. I'm doubting everything about my entire writing career. I think my writing muscle is broken, and I just have to keep telling myself that that is normal from 30 to 40,000 words for me and for many writers. So please tell me you have a slightly happier version of the week.
Well, I have had a very, very busy month with a lot of demands on my time, being required to perform in various ways and sort of get myself together and get my thoughts together. And it has been extremely distracting. And I have been sticking to my writing routine, but I've found my thoughts a bit scattered and that it's more difficult to pull them all into the fold and marshal them and create some kind of coherent narrative. So I'm working on two things at the moment. The one is a sequel to The Hidden, which is about 40,000 words in, and I'm now realizing why I'm doubting it so deeply. I sort of feel as though The Hidden was very gripping and full of twists and turns, and this one is gripping me less. So I'm devoting my thoughts to deciding what can I do to make this a bit more of a nail biter and a page turner. And then I'm working on a more literary book, which is about, I think, 10,000 words in. And I'm still having fun with that. I'm still at the kind of playful having fun stage.
Still in the honeymoon period with that one.
Yes.
Maybe that's the trick. Maybe to work on two things and be in different phases might be the way to get through that sticky middle.
Maybe. Yeah. Are you finding, because I know you've mentioned your Katie Gale books, that the edits were pretty harsh. The editor would come in and sort of require you to change the whole thing. Has that smoothed out? Are you guys getting the formula more right now?
Are we getting better? We don't feel like we're getting better. We feel like every book we write, we cannot believe we're going to have to do this again. Mm-hmm. And we've just started writing the 7th Katie Gale, and so it is our 10th book together.
Wow.
And we still start every book going like, whoa, what do we do now? But the edits on this last one, which is book number 6 in the Julia Bird series, so it's been smoother. The structural edits were quite gentle, and a lot more of our editor going, oh, I love this. I don't know if she was just in a very good mood when she edited it, and maybe she's missed a whole lot of plot holes too. That's also my worst fear. And sometimes we get quite a harsh line edit back. Mm-hmm. So let's not relax quite yet, but it does seem like maybe we're getting a little bit better.
I think when one writes in a genre for a while, you do start nailing those tropes and almost become second nature.
Second nature might be a push, Fiona, but a nature maybe.
So, Gail, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
So, I have actually had a lovely time reading, starting with a terrible time. Mm-hmm. A friend who I trust greatly recommended a book that is a very gritty reality book. And the insight I've had is I cannot bear gritty reality. I cannot bear reading about awful people doing awful things because their lives are awful and they have no hope. I can't.
Casual Vacancy, that J.K. Rowling book.
100%. Casual Vacancy sums up what I cannot bear to read. And this, while I was trying to read this book, I was like, oh, Casual Vacancy. And I stopped halfway through. And then I was feeling a bit desperate about reading, and then was lucky enough to just start reading a whole lot of wonderful books. The two I'm going to tell you about The one everyone's reading at the moment, Good Material by Dolly Alderton.
I can't wait.
About a breakup, and it is funny and it is real. It's not gritty reality. It's nice reality, mm-hmm. but it is still very real. And it's also very interesting as a writer because it's about a comedian whose material has got very tired and he's living through something. And you keep thinking, why aren't you using this as material? And so that it was interesting about the creative process in this way. And then I also read, and the book that actually I read immediately after the Gritty Reality one is a book called The Wakes by Diane Yarwood. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it came to be on my Kindle. I don't know where I got the idea to read it from, but it was just lovely. It's an Australian book about two women who set up a catering firm for wakes, for mm-hmm. post-funeral eating. So it's a bit sad because people have to keep dying for the plot to roll on because they have to mm-hmm. keep doing their catering for the wakes. But it was just lovely and funny, and it had food in it, and it was quirky, and I really, really loved it. It was just a palate cleanser after that gritty reality. So both of those I strongly recommend. And what about you?
I have been reading, but not at my usual pace because of all these distractions going on. But I'm busy reading the latest Jonathan Kellerman, the Alex Delaware novel called The Ghost Orchid. And it is as fresh as ever, as well plotted, as enjoyable. But it really got me thinking about still writing the same character after 30-something years, which he really is doing. Mm. And he has created other characters and attempted other series, but he always goes back to Alex Delaware, probably because those are the most successful and they sell the best. So he's giving the readers what they want year after year. It literally is one fat book per year. And he delivers each and every time. But I know that feeling of fatigue with a character or with a situation. And he's tried to mix it up over the years by breaking up Alex Delaware and his girlfriend or creating something. One of his side characters is the Lieutenant Milo Sturgis, creating some drama in his life. But he eventually always removes the drama and just goes back to the status quo again, because that's probably what the readers love. But how you sustain that enthusiasm and don't get bored with the same characters and the same setting for 30 years, I take my hat off to him. Do you have any insights in how
one can do this? I don't, but I recently listened to a podcast with him, and it was very interesting. In fact, I quoted it at the launch of your book, and it was very interesting because he did say the other books don't sell as well. There is not the demand. People want his Alex Delaware books. They do not want him to go off onto other projects, which is sad in a way. I mean, we a little bit with the Katie Gales, we're writing the same character, the same world, but I think we're in that honeymoon phase where we know it well enough now that it's less effort to write it, and we have enough characters developed that we can just go into our box of characters and take out somebody that we want to use for this book. But we haven't reached the phase that we're bored yet. Mm-hmm. And the boredom is going to be the test. Very scared of it.
Yeah, well, I really respect writers. You can just keep going. And our guest today is actually someone who has a long-running series featuring a single detective. And she, interestingly enough, never brought out the last in the series. She'd written it, but she made the decision not to publish it. Our guest today is Margie Orford. Margie is a South African journalist, film director, and author of crime fiction, particularly the Claire Hart series. Margie's also written children's fiction and nonfiction. She's an activist. She's very active in the public space and most recently has written the memoir Love and Fury. Margie joins us in the studio today, looking as usual like a million bucks. Our listeners will be pleased to hear. Hi, Margie, and welcome.
Thank you so much, Fiona and Gail. It's lovely to be here in the sunny Joburg morning.
So, Margie, we're going to jump right in. What has your writing week looked like? I mean, have you had a writing week? Because you're on a hectic book tour.
I've had, I mean, in a way, a book tour is part of the writing process, in that that's where you go and sort of talk to everyone about your book. So I haven't had time for writing, and I do have another manuscript due this week. And I think it's not going to make it this week for a new novel, kind of follow up to my last novel, which I toured here a couple of years ago, called The Eye of the Beholder. So I've got another one. So I've had a very guilty week, but maybe I should tell you a little bit about what my writing week usually looks like. So towards the end of a book, I work longer and longer hours. So by the time I came on this tour, I was working sort of 10 to 16 hours a day. And I'm living in London now, so usually what I do is go and work in the British Library, which is absolutely silent, and it's open from 10 in the morning till 10 at night. And I get there, and I leave my phone at home.
Oh, brave.
Yep, and I put a block, internet block, on my laptop, and that's me. But the main thing for me for writing is leaving my phone. If I write at home, I give my phone to my husband, who lives downstairs from me. We live in separate houses. And on pain of death, he may not give me my phone until the end of the day, because I can't think with that phone interruption.
And how many thousand words does a 16-hour day look like?
It's interesting. I mean, sometimes I will produce literally 3,000 or 4,000 words, but those are words that need to be kind of shaped and adapted. And I find if I have a very productive day in terms of volume, the next day I won't. But that thinking, or I won't produce a whole lot of stuff, but that thinking, that kind of volume of production is something that I'll work on and kind of shift around in the story. So I don't really set myself a word count, but I do try and keep myself at my desk for at least 4 or 5 hours. When I'm making the story up new, I can work less time, if you know what I mean. When it's kind of like when the novel is kind of finding and you're mapping out the new terrain, and then you'll have a sort of epiphany and write, and you can't carry on. I'm now in the writing and editing mode, so there's stuff to print out. I have 100,000 words. The book is kind of there. So it's a mixture.
Let's talk about that planning phase, and whether are you a plotter or a pantser? How much do you plan ahead? How much do you make up as you're going along?
I don't really plan. I mean, it's interesting. In all my crime novels, which seem to be, people often think the crime fiction is kind of plotted. I'm sure it is with like better and wiser people do it, but I don't do that. All my books have been around one situation or usually a differential of power between two people. And then I try to work out what happened in that moment, how they got there, and what happens afterwards. So I have a kind of vague idea, or I have a vision, a specific vision of what it is that I'm curious about. And then I just write. You know, I teach quite a bit of writing, and I say that to my students, and I repeat it to myself when I lose my courage. All other art forms, you buy or get your raw material. So if you're a ceramicist, you get the clay. If you're a sculptor, you get the wood or the whatever it is. Filmmaker, you have a camera. Painter, you have paints. Writing, you have to make your own material. So I think of that sort of free writing, that kind of volume production, as making my material, which I then shape and discover the shape of how it is. So my plans are usually useless. I mean, I write them to sell them to the publishing. You know, they need a kind of pitch.
Do you stick to that pitch?
Not really. But it's sort of sometimes this vision idea is quite important, because I have like a total image of what the whole thing is going to be and where it will come to rest. But it's a feeling in my body rather than a thought in my cerebral part of my mind. So I follow that feeling.
You talk in Love and Fury about, I've actually even earmarked the page, and maybe I can find it, about having, you say, each one started with a vision that comes to me in the form of a single close-up of two people caught as if by flashbulb in a situation of dominance and submission.
Oh, good. I'm glad I wrote that down.
And good. I was fascinated. I'm not a person who marks up books when I read, but I've earmarked that because I was so fascinated by it, because it's such a different process, because writers aren't always visual.
I storyboard all my books.
Which you also refer to in here. Yeah. Tell us about that.
So I do think very visually, and it kind of how my mind works. I don't know if it's my mind or my brain. I have this feeling about what it's going to be. And it was weird. It was the same with the memoir. It's a bodily feeling. So I actually write by hand. Every single book I've written by hand. And I have thousands of notebooks. I then type it up, print them out, work again by hand. Because to me, a book is an object. It's like a piece of sculpture or something. You know, it's like a three-dimensional thing, which you experience in space, in your hands, and over time. So that dynamic, like, I want to know what the tension is between two people, what it is, where my point of view is, whether you write close up, it's a medium shot, if it's like a far away CCTV type of shot. Each of those is different, gives you different prickle between your shoulders or a different feeling in the chest or whatever. So that's what I go for, is the feeling. And then I do storyboard it. If I get stuck, I kind of storyboard it in the beginning. Halfway through, I work it out, plot who is going to be there. I have my different characters, like you would do for a film. And then I think, okay, I need to capture that particular sensation of embodiment. Otherwise, I can't get to it.
Sure. I'd love to see one of those storyboards. Please, can you share one on social media?
I will. I'll send you some pictures. I mean, so the memoir as well, I storyboarded that because you get an idea of how the rhythm works of a story and what you have in different layers. So, for example, in the memoir in which I do sort of archaeology of memory and the self, it's very similar to fiction in the form. Or in what you're trying to convey. It's like how a person in the present carries with them experiences in the past, which is, for fiction, is what you need. And then you need to storyboard. You need to see the rhythm. You suddenly find too much stuff is happening in one place, and you only see it when it's there, and you think, okay, this can breathe a bit.
Margie, we've talked about the fact that you're touring this book now, your memoir. And I know you've toured many works of fiction before, as have we, and I'm in the middle of promoting a book right now, and it's fiction. I'm writing about a fictional artifact that I created, and I find myself saying the same things over and over again and getting possibly a little bit tired of it and feeling that the tongue is cleaving to the roof of my mouth and that I can't bear the sound of my own voice a moment longer. So I'm in that slightly bad space at the moment. But what is it like when the material that you're talking about is your life? Do you kind of throw up an extra defensive wall because this is your life that everyone's talking about? Or do you feel completely comfortable discussing it as you would any other narrative that you'd created?
That's a very good question. I've been thinking about it a lot because I've never written memoir before. It's the first time. And the writing of it and the thing felt different to the fiction. I don't know. I mean, it's when you tour a book, it's a privilege to be in that position, to be asked to do it. And I get exhausted, but I also, like, thanks to my publisher and Jonathan Ball and various things, and the audiences who come and who are curious, it's a wonderful feeling as a writer to meet and interact with the people who are curious about your work. That said, the crime fiction, you know, or my fiction sort of touring that, I suppose you do have a kind of more of a distance or kind of thing of what you're doing. I mean, I would find a lot of my interviews with a crime fiction would segue into people's experiences of violence and themselves. And I've sort of felt, okay, I write about that stuff. You have to contain it somehow or make a space. In this one, I found I was really nervous about it. And I don't get nervous about these things, but I had kind of no idea of what I've written. If I don't know if that makes sense, but like when you read that bit back to me, I thought, wow, I'll write that. That's amazing. It has been a different interaction with the sort of the vulnerability side of it. I mean, the book is very truthful and open, and it got more and more so through the writing, because I thought, okay, I have to, if you're going to write a memoir about being a woman in the world and, you know, experiencing the things that so many of us have, you've got to be, you can't be coy. You kind of have to say, so you don't want to beat up your reader, but it's also, you have to be open, because you've said, I'm offering to open the house of myself, come in. It's been really touching to me, actually, to see how the work has resonated with people. I've had different kinds of audiences and different kind of responses to people, from people. And it's made me feel, okay, it was worth doing that opening up thing. It helped me in the writing. I mean, I was in a very bad way when I started writing it. And I thought, okay, not that I'm like a girl guide writer and doing good deeds, but I like that connection. I was surprised.
I'm very curious about what made you feel ready to write a memoir. Like, what was the impetus to stop writing fiction? Well, not stop writing fiction, because I'm imagining you did both at once. But why a memoir now?
I left South Africa in 2015. So I had these three fellowships then, one in Scotland, one at the University of York, and then a fantastic one in Italy. And my marriage had just come to an end, and I kind of like sallied forth at the kind of looked like the peak of my career, and my whole life had kind of collapsed around me. I think I had burnout from writing the fiction. I was completely exhausted, and this very millennial long marriage was over. It had been the structure of my life, and I didn't, I never think I'll get tired. I've never thought, I just think keep going, keep going, keep going. And I hit this wall. Also, I couldn't sell The Eye of the Beholder initially. No, that sold like that after Me Too happened. It was very interesting. So the book didn't sell initially to a publisher, because I'd canceled my last sort of Claire Hart thing. So all sorts of things were going on. I was tired of writing crime fiction. But the main thing was, I needed to understand what had happened to me in that period of time and why I'd had this kind of midlife breakdown. And writing the memoir in a way was kind of like trying to pick up the pieces and reassemble them and kind of go on. So the writing kind of really helped me. And then my agent said, let me write a memoir. This was like before COVID. So I did. It was really difficult. I wouldn't advise it. Don't do it.
And did you know from the outset that this was something you were writing for publication? It wasn't an act of personal therapy.
No, I do go to therapy. Writing is not therapy. Absolutely. I mean, yes, writing in your journal, your private writing. Yeah. I mean, I'm a professional writer, so yes. There's no word that I put down which I think, okay, this is, I don't know, it's what I do.
Yeah.
And everything I've written so far in my life has been published. So, yes, so I had the commission. It was commissioned. It was sold. And then it took me much longer. I realized how difficult it is to make sense of one's life and also then to make it into a narrative that other people can follow and be in as a story. Because in a memoir is as constructed as any other piece of writing. It's got different criteria for truthfulness, for example, and for frankness, and for your relationship with the reader is different to fiction. But it's a construction, and it doesn't just come out. I mean, it's had so many different forms and formats. I mean, the Love and Fury starts in 2018. When I'm in London. So there are three layers of time, 2018 to the sort of narrative present, if I can put it, or when it comes out. And then that's layered back to 1989, my first wedding, which was also in London. So it starts and ends with my two weddings. And then a much sort of tectonic time, which is the time of formation and childhood and all of those things that make one the person one is. So I suppose having gone to therapy helped, but it's not therapeutic writing a book. It's terrible writing a book. It's stupid. It's really stupid. I mean, you can do things much more easily by boxing or I don't know, ice skating or just having a nap.
Margie, the first quarter of your book I found personally challenging. I felt as though that voice was challenging me and my life choices because, like you, I got married young and had children, not as young as you, but also quite young. And I didn't have that feeling that in my mind belongs to second wave feminism, that the act of marrying and having babies casts you, as Faye Weldon said, down among the women, that you become this kind of subaltern figure, that your aims and ambitions can no longer really be realized, and that you are doing, and this is sticky for me because I don't know if it's implied, but that the work you are doing is inferior, that the private domestic work of women is inferior to the public, public-facing sort of important work of men. And that is an issue that I struggle with. And I'm wondering where do you fall on that? Do you see the private work of women as of less importance than the public work of men? Or do you just see the removal of choice as the important issue, that women can then no longer choose to operate in the public sphere?
So for your listeners, the story starts with me at 24 going to look where I first got married. And I was pregnant then, living in London, and blissfully pregnant. Like, I'm a serial mother, so I've like repeated. I wish I'd had more children. I felt it was interesting going back to it because I could see a lot. I write a lot about this book about depression. I mean, it sort of starts at a moment where I really had sort of suicidal thoughts. And it was fascinating to me is that my writing would jump me up. I couldn't leave a note. So there was something about this creativity thing in me which kind of kept me going. I don't think it's inferior. I think there's an arrangement of space. So the sort of public and private sphere, the masculine and the feminine world is divided. It's an old Greek division between the doxa, which is the public space, and the oikos, the family private space. And I first read about that, the sort of philosophy of it was with Hannah Arendt in her book, Vita Activa. So that psychogeography of space, the masculine femininization of space, has informed all my thinking and being. But I feel cast out of time. I think what happens to women and for people who are doing caring work is that the work, what is called the work of women or thought of it, is this repetitive care for the body. So it's cleaning and feeding and comforting and, you know, washing the dead and breastfeeding. It's the kind of murk of nature. And Simone de Beauvoir is so brilliant on that, in looking at how one is not born a woman, how you become one. So it's not the work itself. It's the way that it's perceived. And my feeling of being cast, I really had this profoundly, this feeling of being cast out of time and cast out of space. So if I look back on it, my 24-year-old self, that girl had postnatal depression. Mm. That is how we would talk about it now. Mm. But she also had, I also had a massive wave of fury at what happens to people who do the most important jobs, which is make new people and tiny people, is invisible. And it's been, you know, since the dawn of history, it's been your dawn of writing. That realm of the private realm, of the woman's realm, is perceived to be that. So I had a feeling of being exiled from myself. And I love that Faye Weldon book, down amongst the women. I think it's very accurate for the feeling of it. So some of my fury was fighting back and mapping out a terrain. I also had no idea how to be a woman. I didn't know how to be both. I had to figure it out. You know, the models that we had or that I had were complicated. And I think that second wave feminism, that idea that, you know, the women must be in the public sphere, I don't think we've solved that battle. There's a massive backlash, anti-feminist backlash, the sort of tyranny of the body, the anti-abortion movement in the US, or there's a war on the gains that women made in public. I also think what happens with women, sorry, I'm going off my feminist theory. I think what's happened, if you look at what has happened with the medical profession, as more and more women become doctors, the status and the pay goes down. So with teaching, it's the same. It's become a feminized job and the pay goes down and the social standing goes down. So that battle is not won. And for me, the experience I was describing was this impossible feeling of being exiled and made into a non-person, a suburban mother. You know, it's it was interesting, that, to me. And the story I write is how I fought my way back, which was by forcing someone to give me a job as a saving thing. But it's interesting about depression for women as well, because how much of that postnatal depression or that rage, entrapment, and thinking about other people's alimentary tracts, which drives me mad, and their socks and things. That was an issue for me. And how much of it is endogenous, i.e. coming from a so-called chemical imbalance, and how much of it is the social politics of your intimate life?
You've given me so much to think about that I can barely think. But what I'm curious about, how different do you think it is for your daughters having seen your example, a very different example? Because I'm thinking, I had a very different experience of motherhood, but I also had an older motherhood. And I, as you were speaking, I was thinking maybe it's because I had something different modeled to me. Do you think you've changed it for your daughters?
Yes, I do. I really do. I think I absolutely have changed it. With intent.
Mm.
With intent. I mean, I have three daughters. I have a different model. I mean, I look at my lovely and brilliant mother, and her gifts were channeled into making my father, who's a doctor, the star of the show. And, you know, I mean, everything was kind of like revolved around him. I mean, the great thing of patriarchy, as Freud said, it's His Majesty the baby. I mean, men who operate in that dimension, they really think they are the son because the people around them make them feel like that. And often with good reason, because you'll provoke them and then they're violent or sulk or withdraw affection. You know what I mean? It's a careful balance, the egos of men. But for my daughters, yes, I do think I've modeled something different. I mean, it's a different generation. Feminism is taking on different ideas. They're also suffering from a backlash, you know what I mean, of all sorts of questioning. But they've just like sallied forth in their lives, in their sort of creative and professional lives. And I think they have like different expectations of themselves. You know, they absolutely, and they've had a mother who's modeled, you know, sort of economic self-sufficiency. I can take care of them. I have economically. And, you know, that, you know, like I'm a boss lady and they are boss ladies. I see that.
You've talked about in the memoir, you talk about the importance of daughters seeing their mothers engaged in the world and passionate about something. And in your own life, your mother ventured forth on her own path for a while and then changed and went back to being a support to your father. And one would think common wisdom would dictate that the child would love that. Oh, I've got mommy back. Mommy's, you know, paying full attention to me. But you, the child, didn't like that your mother made that choice. It, as I recall it, it angered you that she made that choice to withdraw from public life and just become a support to your father. How important is that for children of any gender to see their mothers engaged in the world?
Well, I think there's nothing worse than full attention from your mother. It's a bit like the Stasi.
Note to self.
Yeah. I think, my theory of children is that they benefit from a system of benign neglect.
100%.
Children, in my experience of them, they like that you're sort of there somewhere, but they don't want you bothering them and improving them and edifying them and making them do interactive games and stuff. I think it's absolutely vital for boys, especially boys, but boys and girls. I haven't had boys. To see both the parents as equal and interactive people. There is nothing worse than living with a person who has been thwarted. There's nothing worse for a child. A greatest burden is to carry out the wishes or the unfulfilled wishes of the parent. Mm. And you see it, it's easy to see with boys whose fathers, or with children whose fathers are very competitive with them. You know what I mean? Mm. Or they want them to be something on their behalf. Mm. No, live your own life. You know, there's something deeply damaging about the unlived life of the parent. I think that, you know, that there's that fantastic book about midlife, James Hollis, the Middle Passage. Jung talks about it. Freud talks. I mean, everybody, you can see it. We've all got, know people who've got half-lived lives. So much more important, I think, for children, of course they need the time and the affection and all of that, but it is to have a parent who is, fulfills their potential, because it offers a model that you can be a complete and whole person. So for me, and I remember my mom saying when I got a scholarship to go to New York, a Fulbright scholarship when I was 35. So and my mother was amazing. She said to me, she said, "Darling, the worst thing you can do to your children is say, what if? What if I'd done this? What if I'd done that?" And it was quite a thing, because it meant I had to leave them for a year. Then they joined me for the second year. But that was some of the best advice I've ever got, is not to live with what if, which then blames the child, saying, "I sacrificed this for you." There's nothing worse than self-sacrifice, especially if you make your child aware that you've now sacrificed yourself for them. How can they live with it?
So much to think about there. I'm thinking of yelling at my children, "The things we've given up for you."
You chose to give them up.
Absolutely, and gave them up willingly. Yeah. But I want to move away now from parenting and women to place. Place plays a huge part in your memoir. You split the book according to where you are, and you give us a deep sense of place as you write about it. You really take us into those places. Can you talk to me about that, the role of place in your life and how it changed you?
Yes, place and movement. So the book is divided. It starts in London, then Namibia, where I was in Windhoek, then New York, I was there for 2 years, Cape Town, and then back to London. And I did like that route, like closing the circle. I'm sure I'll go and live somewhere else. So place and movement, I think, are linked for me. I mean, by the time I was 8 or 9, we'd already lived in, I think, 13 houses. So I had got used to moving. Any difficulty I have, my immediate solution is move. Walk, move, pack, go. Which all my therapists have told me is bad, and I think they're wrong. Because, like, what else do you do with
judgmental?
Yeah, exactly. So I do experience place very vividly. So one of the things I took over from fiction writing is the creation of psychogeography, like where you are in place, what it feels like. I did grow up in Namibia, which has the most overwhelming landscape. It's so huge. And so what I love about it is that you feel so tiny as a person. You feel like a little speck, a little ant. And it's the most comforting feeling because you're not insignificant. It's just a feeling of proportion, that you're small and this place is big, which is perhaps a key thing with parenting. The child can feel, this is how I saw it, able to be small because you are big. You can absorb it and they feel contained. There's like a right proportion. So Namibia was very formative to me and how to be in the landscape, how to understand it, how to read it, and how it enters into you. But each of those places was so pivotal. I mean, I was in London in the late 80s. I'd been in detention, and South Africa was just so traumatized and traumatic at the time. And I didn't realize it at the time, and I ran away. I couldn't function here anymore. So that was a particular time. Namibia, I absolutely loved, like, making my bazillions of babies and rooting down, making a career.
And that house in Namibia sounds lovely with the jewel-colored rooms.
Yes, it was such
I really wanted to go there.
Yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful house. I mean, I love making houses and homes. There is a thing, as soon as they've finished, then I move to another one. I've not cottoned onto the idea that you could live in a house. I think of a house as a thing to make and then move again. I don't know why. I mean, I do know why, but I can't do anything about that. Then I got this amazing fellowship to New York. And that's where my mind kicked back in. I promised myself, as I write about in the book at 24, that I would do everything later. And then I got this scholarship and I thought, okay, that's later. It came in the post. And it's very scary. And I thought, I have to do this. I have to fulfill the promise to the self that I split off, because I'd never thought of having children, never entered my head until I had them, or husbands. I couldn't see why. I didn't think about it. And then I had this splitting off between my like mind self and this baby producing self. So that was New York, and that gave me the perspective back onto South Africa to write about it when I came back to live here. And then I lived here a long time, and then I burnt out, and then I went back to London. Like a salmon. I was born there, so I returned like a salmon to see if I could find anything.
But as you say, you don't know where your salmon journey will take you next.
I've got some ideas. I've got a couple of theories.
And speaking of salmon returning to sort of old safe harbors, let's talk about marriage for a moment. You describe how pretty early on in your marriage, you had a sense that you had given away a part of yourself, that you'd lost some aspect of your selfhood in binding yourself to this arrangement. And then many years later, you make the decision to free yourself from that arrangement. And you reflect in a very striking way on the safety that marriage gives to women, I think particularly of our generation, maybe not so much the youngsters. But then, having freed yourself, you then chose to re-enter the state of marriage. And I was very interested to hear that you and your husband sort of live in separate spaces. Why marry again? And are the separate spaces the solution to happiness, Gail? And I would love to know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Have your own bedroom, your own study, your own front door, your own bathroom. Writing is an obsessive compulsive disorder. You asked me about writing, and to me it's like a psychiatric symptom. I would not do it if I could find another thing to do. So I think that marital thing is interesting. I mean, I'm not suited to marriage, clearly, even though I keep doing it. I found it very difficult. I have no interest in merger with another person at all. It was so hard to become myself. I found as an adolescent very, very difficult. I had some real ruptures in my early adolescence, and I have a phobia of losing myself. It really is a phobia, which is not a good idea for some forms of marriage, especially when you're young, there's a fantasy, you know, in your 20s and 30s, there's a fantasy of merging in with another person as if, which is very like mother-child dyad, all of that stuff. I'm not suited to it. And I fight for my space. It's stupid sometimes. Most of the time it's just dumb, but I do. So I think I found that difficult about marriage to my first husband. Interestingly, writing this memoir, you talk about the feeling of unprotection. When I went to court and the judge like did the decree nisi, the word that comes to my head is undefended. It was like I'd originally actually thought of calling the memoir Undefended because it was just booming in my mind that I was no longer defended. It was a weird word. I don't know where it came from. And then I realized that it had given me a lot of defense. So marriage is a very private thing. So in some ways, the loneliest place is an unhappy marriage because it gives a veneer of happiness. And I found one of the most liberating things was when I said I was unhappy and it wasn't working. I felt that sort of loneliness disappeared because I could share with people. But when you're unhappy and in it, it's so lonely because it all looks so perfect. And there's a massive social idealization about that arrangement. Yeah, and then I didn't, which nearly practically killed me, the post-divorce thing. But I think it had come much earlier. But writing it, this is the great gift of writing and the truthfulness. I loved the person I married the first time around and made the babies with. The babies were made out of love. And writing, I could re-find that feeling. It was because you have to be truthful. I wouldn't say, oh, he was like always terrible. He wasn't. He was never terrible. He married the wrong person, poor guy. So it was interesting seeing how that worked and that a marriage to a person is also, you're changing and growing all the time. It becomes, it's a very fixed institution. It's a bit like motherhood, I think, is a fixed institution where it's so individual, each one. Why did I get married again? Well, number of reasons. My dad said to me, he said, oh, triumph of hope over experience. And I remember flashing back and thinking, how can anybody live without hope? Which I still wonder about. But I hadn't had any plans. And then as I write about in the book, my very beloved sister died in November 21. And she and I were so close. And she was always my family. I realized when she died, we'd always had this joke that she and I would retire to the St. James Hotel and drink gin and smoke cigarettes and gossip about everyone we knew. And I understood, maybe this is why I could never be married properly the first time. She was my lifelong person. That was where my center of gravity would be. And we would say, once all the husbands and boyfriends are done with, so clearly both of us didn't really see men as the central thing. They were like sort of supporting actors, and they would go off on their own paths. And I realized I had no idea how to go on. I had no imagination. I know this doesn't sound romantic. And so then I said to this victim number two, I said, I wanted to be permanently engaged. I thought that sounded great, you know, to be permanently engaged, like permanent revolution. But he is an ex-communist and he hates trots. And apparently Trotskyites have permanent revolution. So we had like a whole post-communist prompt. And he likes to finish things. He's a sportsman. And so he wanted to get married. So I thought, oh, all right then. So
that's a very unusual reason for getting married, because of post-Trotsky communism.
I thought so, but like, why not? Why not?
As good a reason as any, actually.
I mean, apparently I have to, Trotskyites are the worst people. I had no idea. I was never a communist, but Stalinist, which is clearly, if you're not a Trot, you must be a Stalinist. Anyway, so good old 1980s factional politics fed into this marital decision.
Is this a good time for me to mention that I'm distantly related to Trotsky?
Oh my God.
Sorry.
Excellent.
Sorry, Margie's husband.
No, I have no animus against Trotsky. It was very funny. And I found it funny, but, so Gavin had been married before as well. And we have like these five children. And there was something, I mean, I still don't know. I like being married. It's this, something companionable about it. But it was also something to do. I mean, maybe it just took me well over 50 years to be separated from my birth family. I sometimes wonder that, you know what I mean? Finally, I separated. My sister died, and then that was my primary attachment, clearly. I don't know. Who knows? And then it was great to have – I love weddings, so we had a nice wedding. Our five daughters gave us away, my three and his two.
So he's also got daughters.
Got two, yeah, so we have five daughters between us, 34, 33, 31, 30, and 27. This is like an army of them.
We are a bit obsessed with the power of older women. I don't know if it's me more than Fiona, but I think we're both a little bit obsessed with the power of older women and that power that comes with age. How are you finding the difference between kind of writing as a younger woman, being in the world as a younger woman, and now being in the world as an older woman and writing as an older woman? Still young, let me point out.
No, I don't. Look, you either get older or you die. So that's cool with me. I don't feel that different. I mean, it's interesting. I, weirdly enough, have always felt a sense of like power and fightiness. I never had much fear of anything. So in some ways, I feel like a sort of consistency of the self. And I, you know, I mean, I've been a feminist since before I could talk, I think. It really annoyed me to be overwhelmed or to be teased or to be, you know, have women mocked and stuff. I don't know. It just annoyed me. To be like writing now as an older woman, I mean, I have got wiser. You sort of see, you can see patterns of things. My politics has become more radical, I think, because as I've understood stuff better, could see I was right. I wasn't just pissed off. I was right about the injustices. I'm extremely worried about what's happening to women globally. Massive backlash. And it's very dangerous, the rise of these incels. I mean, misogyny is absolutely real. These more and more killings, you know, femicidal murders and stuff like that. And that's because women have made a slight dent on male power. So I think, or masculine, patriarchal power, whatever. So I haven't found a different. I don't know. I haven't minded at all getting older. I think my investment has been, I've always perceived of myself as a person in the world getting by on her wits. Yeah. So have I got less attention? No. That's one of the people I often hear this complaint that you disappear. No, you don't disappear. You just get harassed less. What you see is how much energy you spend as a young woman dealing with this incredible hostility of the male gaze. So you've got like more space. So I don't know. I haven't found it. It's not a thing that I've thought about much.
Okay.
Let's talk for a moment about sexual violence, because this is something that you write about. And I think part of the reason that it seemed as though only later in life could you look back and acknowledge what happened to you is because for a long time, we recognized two responses to violence, which is fight or flight. And if women did neither, the idea was, oh, well, obviously it wasn't sexual violence that they experienced. They didn't fight back and they didn't run away, so they must have been cool with it. And now there's been this insight, which I've learned about recently, that there are two other related responses, which are freeze and fawn. And to freeze in place and hope that this ends quickly, and to fawn upon the attacker so that he doesn't do anything worse to you. What were the triggers that, was it actually writing the memoir that helped you realize the things that had been done to you and think about them in the proper way for the first time.
Yes, it was very much so. So I describe, I mean, I've had a number, like I'm sure everybody listening, every single woman listening here, have had a series of sexual assaults, which I kind of displaced and you, in many ways, used to write in my fiction. Mm. So, you know, people would say to me, how do you write the novels you do? And what I would do is go back to, I don't want to call it my rape because of what, but I was raped when I was a young woman. That would be the space I would go to, but I didn't, you know, I didn't think it was that bad or what, it, you know, but that I knew what I was writing about through the body, this like body feeling. But I just thought, I just like split it off. And there were others. And it was, yeah, going to the memoir, I had to understand that. So I describe in one of the things coming to see where my own daughter, my oldest daughter, first gets to puberty, an experience she had where she wasn't assaulted, but she was harassed at school. And that made me remember, you know, well, think about properly, because I'd absolutely fought for her and didn't broke that sort of silence that many of us grow up with around the shame that you absorb. So through my fiction writing, I've thought a lot about the economy of shame, because, and I've worked with prisoners, as many people will know, and I've worked a lot with perpetrators, and they are shameless. And I used to think with my economy, where does shame go? Goes like a VHS into the player, which is the victim, and then she plays that shame. It's never lost. Just one person doesn't feel it. So the idea of shamelessness and shame and why you absorb this kind of inadequacy into yourself, it's like a cellular feeling. So there's a long theme, I suppose, of discovering, doing an archaeology of shame in the book, and how I came to absorb it, and then play it, and it silences you. So those things you mentioned, the fawn, the freeze, the fight and flight, they all methods of surviving. Any woman who does any of them, or you know, men who are victim of sexual assault too, you survived. Ace. You made it through. It doesn't matter how. You just get through it. So I think that it was important to me to write about that. A, what I've done with those experiences. I mean, some of them are grits, if they shape you in a particular way. You know, you kind of do a pearl formation over it. Writing about it was really difficult. I mean, there was, I realized it was completely divided in myself. I had split it off in the most classic, and it was like behind a wall of glass. And I remember writing about one of the experiences, and I had this absolute body, I was shaking and sick. I had the reaction. This was a thing that happened to me when I was about 15 or 16. So 40 years later, my body finally reacted. My body finally reacted to this thing that had been there all that time before. So it had lived in there.
Margie, you write in Love and Fury, and I have heard you speak before about the way you see fiction as almost a duty of witnessing violence against women and other types of violence. You know, you don't write escapist fiction that's going to protect us from the terror in the world. You take us into the face of the terror in the world. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Well, I wrote a memoir, which is everybody escapes in the end. yeah, I do. It is important. I mean, I suppose it's the journalist thing. It's also growing up in a very, in a war, civil war that wasn't declared in South Africa. And I do have a strong and like simplistic feeling, which I've had since I was tiny, that you have to tell the tale. I think the worst thing we tell our children is don't tell tales. It's such an easy thing. It rolls off the tongue. But it's telling children to keep secrets. Why do we want a secret? It's usually because the adults don't want to be ruffled by what this child has seen or observed or experienced. I think the same applies for adults. We need to bear witness to what we see. So let's, for example, there have been many and usually failed campaigns about to men, that men can stop male violence. They do it. Mm-hmm. They can stop it. They can tell tales on their friends. They can bear witness to it. Mm-hmm. It's an important role. I did also come back after the scholarship which I had in the US, and where a lot of work was being done on trauma studies, on the sort of Holocaust remembrance stuff. There was a very interesting kind of philosophical moment which informed me greatly, as did the work that was being done around the TRC in South Africa about witnessing and its failures. So I think even if it fails, you still have to give an account. And that's like a journalistic thing. You see something, you report it, you make sure other people do it. It's the only way of stopping things. I do. I mean, I'm very interested in form and how you tell the truth. Fiction, to me, tells a different kind of truth. You get to an emotional truth and a historical truth. So maybe I should never have, maybe I'd like waste my time writing all that crime fiction. But at the time, I didn't think of it as doing genre. I thought this is the only form with which I can bear witness to what was happening in South Africa in the mid-2000s. I wanted to write about history with a small H as opposed to big, you know, Mandela sweeps of epicness. I wanted to write about what it felt like on in the minutia when people are not intellectualizing about what experiences. So, yeah, my genre thing was not, it just was the form that worked. I don't write crime fiction in the UK. It's a waste of time. That is a fantasy. You know, I mean, they do murder each other in a weird way in England, but generally they don't. And it's, the crime fiction is pointless to me. It's, I don't know, I wouldn't write it. I'm interested in what goes on in the mind and what people do.
When men write about sexual violence, they very often write across the body of a beautiful, naked, dead woman. And that kind of becomes an icon which is sexualized and fantasized about. As a woman writer, I know you struggled with the ethics of this. And how did you write your way around that? I know that there was a book that you actually, it remained unpublished, where you were writing about the child pornographic industry and things that happened to children. And you couldn't bring yourself to finish that or to put it up for publication. So have you successfully wrestled with the ethics of this, or is it an ongoing process?
Ethics, it's like mud wrestling. It never comes to an end. So it is something that I've thought about. So just a simple thing as a writer, what you can disrupt the spectacle of violence, you know, where you have this kind of screen, which is the woman's body, you know, beautiful young woman, corpse that sets the story going, which is also full of judgment, because of course all beautiful young women are meant to be dead because they're femme fatale and they temptation and all that stuff. Simply how I've disrupted it as a writer, I think in my books, is to bring in other senses, smell, for example, and touch, you know, the things that bring the sort of intimacy of, you know, because you can look at something from afar and it doesn't really affect you in the way that being close does. So to me, the option was not, you can't say it's too ugly, it's too terrible, I'm not going to describe it. I did try and find a way to describe it, and it's not possible. I burnt out. It destroyed me, that project. But with the fiction, with the thing about child pornography, that Claire Hart novel, that was about the gaze, because an investigator, even if she's female, like Dr. Hart is, you're still looking at the victim. And I just thought with the production of child pornography, which had come up in the research I'd been doing, you know, it's just a kind of byproduct, all sorts of pornography as a byproduct of other crimes, I couldn't reproduce that gaze. So the eye of the beholder, in a way, is what it feels like. So that is a book which is entirely about the making of images, and you never see them. So I constantly frustrate the desire to see, which of course, as soon as you see, you're distant, you have control, it's not happening to you. So that was formerly quite difficult, to write a book about images where you never see them, to frustrate my reader the whole way through. Mm. The novel I'm writing is around that again. So it's to frustrate that scopic sense, which is quite fun and important. But writing about violence doesn't go away if you don't write about it. Also, though, I think in a lot of my books is that you see there's a lot of survival and resilience. So I'm very interested. Mm. I was interested in myself. I never thought of myself as a survivor, but I am, like most women. And I remember thinking why I must put that experience in. I was sitting in bucolic Oxford around a table with two friends, two women I know, one who's been friends with a very long time and another one who I've become friends with. And tumbling out on this table, all three of us recounted experiences of rape as young women. And I just thought, okay, I didn't know that about them. None of us had really sort of bothered to speak of it. It was just something we'd swallowed like a hand grenade. And I thought, this is all of us. Because it's very painful if you know someone who's been sexually assaulted, who's close to you. And then the Me Too movement happened, and that was very, everyone knows about Me Too, that what was important is women were believed. Mm-hmm. That public gaslighting stopped. What I found, another aspect of it, is that I believed myself, which I found quite striking.
Mm.
And I think that's what happened to a lot of women. They started believing themselves, and they say, yes, it was that bad. That thing happened. And why do you not want to believe yourself? It's an important defense mechanism, because you think, I refuse to believe that I was so worthless that somebody would make me into a thing. A thing is dead. It's inanimate. So you take in that shard of glass, that murderousness, into yourself through the gaze. So part of believing yourself is, like, I think, pushing it back to where it belongs.
You refer, when you talk about that house in Namibia that I want to go to turning the garage into a room of your own. Mm. And obviously echoes of Virginia Woolf and a room of your own. How important do you think that space of your own, whether actual physical or intellectual space of your own, is for anyone, but especially a woman, to self-actualize?
Especially a woman. You have to make a space of your own. It's not possible for everybody to have like a garage that I was fortunate in. But take somebody's bedroom. Take the space. It's very important psychologically. I remember my granny saying to me, who I adored, she said to me, when you walk into a room, put your 2 feet there at a cocktail party. And she says, that's your territory. And that has stayed with me all my life. You don't need the whole room. You just need where you stand to be yours. So a way I found of making a space, if I couldn't have a room of my own, is A, to rent or borrow one, or to go to a cafe where you have a place that's always yours. But take and make a space. And when you close the door, what's very important is for yourself and the other people, is that when you say, don't interrupt me, nobody interrupts you. It's your space, it's your time, it's your thoughts, because that idea that your thinking process is valuable and is yours and is not to be interrupted. If you say that to other people, you will come to believe it yourself, and then you will get your book done. But that spatial thing, women have not been able to own property until really recently as absolutely their own, especially married women. We don't have our own space. Just take it. Take it. Move someone out.
Love that.
Love it too. Margie, what have you been reading or listening to or watching lately that has made an impression on you, either good or bad?
I have read some fantastic new books, which I obviously can't remember, but the titles of them. But a writer who I was late to the party with is Elizabeth Strout, and her whole series, The Olive Kitteridge, but the Lucy Barton novels, I absolutely loved. Her way of creating fictional memoir and stuff like that, I found that absolute genius, what she was doing. So when I was writing the memoir, I read a great number of memoirs. I mean, it's a highly crafted form. And to get the sort of feeling of like openness and frankness, I read a lot about what other memoirists, especially women memoirists, were writing about how to write the body. So a friend of mine, Marina Benjamin, wrote a book about the labor of women, what you were asking me earlier, what they do. All sorts of memoirs. I read a lot of poetry, actually, sort of contemporary poets, because I was aiming for a style that was really kind of spare and visual and evocative rather than descriptive or explanatory. I don't want people to feel I'm like explaining myself or justifying myself. I wanted to try to present the feeling of what it feels like to be alive, which is really difficult. I can't watch TV. If I watch it, I can't sleep for 2 nights at least, because the little jumpy things in my brain start going. But I watched a fantastic series and didn't sleep, called Prison, I think. It's a Danish series set in a prison about the prison guards. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Same woman who was in The Killing. So I like that. And then mostly I've just been reading my own drafts, which is a nightmare.
And when are we going to see that follow-up to The Eye of the Beholder? When will it be published?
Next year, hopefully. Next year. Yeah, it's called Common Purpose, so I have to get it in and get it done. It's scheduled for 25.
My own personal question for me is, am I brave enough to read it after the first one? And I'm not sure. You've got to be brave to read your books.
Oh, come on. No. I think you should read it. It's got a very satisfactory ending.
Okay.
Again.
Again, yes. And again. You promised me that last time and you delivered.
Yes.
You did deliver on it.
Yes. I've been a bit scared of this book. The model I've been reading, you asked me about what I was reading. I've been reading lots of the Greeks. So the Greek plays, Bacchae is one I've been reading a lot, and people can Google that and see how that ends up. But there's something, I've gone against the sort of fictional thing. I wanted to get something to write when an event is inevitable. So it's a kind of psychological portrait again.
Well, we can't wait for the new book, and we hope everyone will check out your memoir, Love and Fury. It's a cracker of a book. It is incredibly gripping, fiercely intelligent, such a good, well-crafted story. We hope everyone buys that. And also checks out your Claire Hart backlist, your new novel, Eye of the Beholder, and we're looking forward to the next one. Margie, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Gail, it was such a privilege to talk to Margie Orford. She is such a smart, smart woman. I could have listened to her for a whole other hour, but we had to let her go on her very hectic book tour. But how nice.
So clever, so insightful. Half the things she told us, I'm going to have to take to therapy. Half the things she told us were so useful as a writer. That really was that feeling of a masterclass.
So what stood out for you in terms of usefulness?
So I'm very interested in the storyboard idea, because I am... My secret talent is I can slightly draw. I am a slightly visual person.
Okay.
And I do often half draw an idea. And the idea of storyboarding the idea is something I'm now going to think about. Can I play with that? And that's why I'd love to see one of her storyboards and how far she actually takes it. Mm-hmm. So that I really loved. And then the space of one's own. Mm-hmm. And that idea of respecting one's own space in order to get the creating done. And I don't know if I do that enough. So, like I said, half to therapy, half to being a better writer. What about you, Fiona?
I was very struck by what she said about the raw material of a writer and how she compared it to a ceramicist, say, whose raw material is clay, which you then shape with your hands and then fire in an oven and then paint, and this whole creative process. And you were talking earlier about good material, the book, and what one uses from one's life as material. And I'm imagining Margie giving these writing classes to prisoners in prisons and teaching them how to use the material of their lives to create writing. You know, I don't know whether they were writing memoir or fiction or whatever, but just what is legitimately the raw material for the writer and what the process of shaping and firing it is.
Very interesting. Fiona, what is your advice to those writers trying to shape their raw material this week?
Well, all I can tell you is what I've really been struggling with this week, which is to get my tone right. And although I'm not a particularly humorous person in real life, on the page, I keep finding humor creeping into my writing, kind of almost willy-nilly. I'll be writing about something very serious, and then humor creeps in. And when I look back at it, it's almost jumping from tone to tone. I need to sort of iron it out and become more consistent with it.
Are you sure it's a problem?
Yeah, in some ways it can be a strength to have moments of lightness and moments of humor and a sort of maybe wry take on the world.
Yes.
But in that very raw state where I'm just reading over what I've written, it can be a bit jarring. So having to process it into the narrative in a way that seems seamless is my current struggle. So I don't really have advice, but that's what I'm struggling with right now. What's your advice?
So I can't give you any advice on that, but I'm quite excited to give the advice I've got because it relates back to what you said at the beginning of this hour, or a bit more than an hour. And that is, I listened to a podcast with Sophie Hannah, who writes amazing thriller type crime fiction mystery. And she always sets up an impossible premise and then writes out of that impossible premise, which is...
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I've read her. I know.
And she talked about how she starts. And she teaches a lot of writing and she teaches this technique. And she starts with a blurb. And she writes the blurb for the book that she's going to write. So that she has this touchstone to come back to. Is she delivering on the promise of the blurb? To keep coming back to that, the tension she created in the blurb, is she delivering on that in the writing? And I'm quite excited to try that as a method. And then she also talked about something called the gnocchi method and invited people to email her and she'll send how to do the gnocchi method. I haven't done that yet, so I don't know what it is, but I will report back.
I'm dying to hear. So if you have read Margie Orford's latest memoir, Love and Fury, or you've read any of her Claire Hart books or her latest novel, Eye of the Beholder, if you have any thoughts on writing methods that we've been talking about, please get in touch. We're on all social media across the board and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.